as we've gotten deeper and deeper into mindfulness, you know, speaking with so many really amazing thinkers and leaders like Jon Kabat-Zinn, you know, who's the modern day father of mindfulness. And every time you think of curriculum or you see articles and books, his name's often there. And the curriculum actually is his, you know, MBSR.
Founder.
Yeah, original curriculum. So to become great friends with him and to get guidance and advice and to help shape our way of thinking on this subject has been huge. Speaking with Matthew Ricard, Daniel Goleman, Chad Mintan, Danny Williams, Mark Williamson, Lord Layard. It's really helped nurture our passion for mindfulness.
And but inspire us to continue the pursuit as well.
And what I wanted to focus on today is the relationship between philosophy and mindfulness. You know, A, is there a relationship? And B, how mindfulness has affected us. And how quite, I don't know if it's ironically or quite coincidentally that when you introduced me to Descartes many years ago, and I have a book here from Sarah. She bought this after, you know, us having spoken to her about it was my birthday. So look, this is July 2005.
Wow.
You know, wishing you a birthday filled with love, joy and laughter. May your days progress with newfound adventures and lasting friendship.
Yeah.
So, you know, Descartes' key philosophical writings.
Yeah, yeah.
And how having conversations about the, well, what if this was all an illusion? You know, what if this reality was in fact us being tricked by an evil demon? So even when we began reading about this many, many years ago and having these conversations, for me, I feel it teed up and helped prepare us for the deeper aspects of mindfulness. And people don't like to use the idea of levels in mindfulness, but I think if you're trying to progress in your understanding of it, sometimes it does help to, you know, put analogies and metaphors. And I think a step or levels, if you like, is a particularly good one. So before we dig into that again, so what we're trying to do today is rather than just focus on all the physical benefits of mindfulness, you know, helping with psoriasis, back pain, with dealing with cancer, coping and stress, and the productivity, you know, in the workplace, right? Performance, right? Creativity, memory, less sick days, better, you know, corporate citizenship. So there's all that stuff. And the reason why we've led with those points is because that's what's backed by science. That's where all the research has been proving and continues to prove and back. But what we want to touch on today is, you know, going back to the good old Descartes, the nature of reality.
Yep.
Because when we mention the word philosophy, we're actually, you know, at its core, the dictionary definition of philosophy is, you know, the
love of wisdom.
The love of wisdom, right? And if, you know, if wisdom be and wisdom is something worth pursuing, right? If you're trying to think, well, what is happiness? What is our purpose? Wisdom's right up along there. And in fact, what is our purpose and why are we here? And what should we be doing is very much one of the key questions in our lives, right? We're talking about the big questions. And philosophy is a huge, plays a huge role in that. And more recently, at least in Western cultures, the mindfulness, what that is actually opening us up to. And then when you practice mindfulness and you go through the different stages, I guess, you know, just to throw out a few now, the stage of first being aware, oh crap, I am thinking all day long. You know, you could live your life not even realizing that this is going on and believe that it's this, is like it's merged together. And then there's the awareness, and it can come very quickly or it can come very slowly, where it's like, wow, that's a thought, and that's a thought, and just, you could just pinpoint all day long, wow, that's a thought and that's a thought. Then the question then arises, well, you know, who is doing the thinking? Who is observing the thinking? Right, there's the witness, almost the observer to the thought. And then that is a very profound moment. The second, and then when you go beyond that, you begin applying it throughout your day. So it's not just me meditating for 10 minutes in the morning. It's like, not only am I noticing myself having thoughts throughout the day, but then I'm actually now doing something about it. In that moment of me noticing a thought, I'm bringing myself back to the present.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, you know, as we spoke with Leo from actualize.org, and when we've spoken with Matthew Ricard and John Kabat-Zinn, when we're talking about the deeper levels of mindfulness, it's like, where is the space? Or, you know, when we say we're present, what does that actually mean?
Yeah.
It's very easy to say, oh yeah, you do that, you anchor your breath and you're back in the present.
Yeah.
Well, what does the present actually mean?
Yeah.
Because when we are in the present, our thoughts put together this, okay, well, when we're lost in thought, our thoughts put and shape together the ego of Anne and your physical body, your meat wagon,
mm-hmm.
your race, your beliefs, your religious beliefs, your job, your friends, your culture, your socioeconomic group, everything, right? All that. And that's Anne. And then it takes into consideration how confident you are about your looks and your weight and your education and how you comport yourself and where you fit into society. All that, that's
your identity.
Your identity. Yeah. And, you know, without going into too much detail now on the specifics, but, you know, ultimately, when you are present, all that kind of dissipates. The ego dissolves.
Mm. Mm.
And that is such a mind trip to understand. And there is so much learning and so much reading and so much mentorship that is required to get to the point. I'm not saying that, you know, we are enlightened and we're in the present all the time. But you know, there have been moments where it's like just to experience it for a brief moment, where it's just like, and you hear it often when people say, I feel a connection with everything. I feel like, you know, the universe is one. And I feel, you hear that, you know, quite often from different cultures, from different people, from different experiences. And in that moment, I just felt that everything was connected.
Mm.
And so, yeah, let's dig into that a little bit. So, as you originally introduced me to Descartes,
mm-hmm.
why don't we go back to where it all first began?
Yeah.
And, you know, how we even got into these conversations and, you know, the cogito ergo sum and why that was so important and how when mindfulness came into our lives, we were able to then apply all the groundwork and the training, if you like, of, well, what does it mean? What would life be like if this actually were an illusion? How would you live your life differently?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, yeah.
So, I mean, the original motivation for, I suppose, looking into philosophy was the kind of philosophy that we sort of seek now, which is more Eastern philosophy, actually, than the Western tradition. I mean, he's, you know, the father of Western philosophy is René Descartes. But I think originally, I mean, if we look back to in the tradition of Western philosophy, they do sort of the philosophy of life. So our motivation wasn't the kind of technical philosophy of, you know, that you'd get trying to analyze language and, you know, sort of very, very technical sort of stuff that is very abstract. You know, we were just looking for, I suppose, ethics. You know, how should one live? You know, what is the best way to spend our time? Mm-hmm. Essentially, you know, I'm given a certain number of years on this planet, and I want to maximize that time, spend it as best I could. And that would go mm-hmm. back to Aristotle's search for the good life and the Stoic philosophers in the Western tradition. So those were, I think, the kind of things we were seeking.
Mm-hmm.
And Descartes became quite... So his was searching for the foundations of knowledge itself, you know,
yep.
seeking certainty and truth.
Yeah, and that's an important point important there, right? Truth. Because... Yeah, yeah. Before you make any decision, you know, like Bertrand Russell said, you know, make sure it's based on the facts. And so we take that really lightly, to, you know, what are facts and what is truth? Because then when you know, if you take the incorrect things to be truth, then all your arguments that you build thereafter do not hold true because their foundation isn't true. And what he's trying to do is strip down to the foundation in its purest form so that he could, you know, rebuild back up.
Yeah, and, you know, we mentioned the ego, actually, and how it's an illusion. And modern philosophy, that's where they depart. Where they depart from Descartes and, his central to his philosophy, the famous cogito, I think, therefore I am. Mm-hmm. The self. And I think interestingly, how the connection there with meditation, I suppose, mindfulness meditation in particular, is the fact that it reveals that this self, this ego, this I, is an illusion, so that it actually... And modern philosophers, modern thinkers, scientists agree that the self is an illusion. Mm. So this is not... But that's still very hard, I think, to grasp without... Because even the greatest minds in the past, you know, didn't see it like that.
Yeah, and know? Even...
When Central to his philosophy was the idea that I think, therefore I am.
But the idea of the self being an illusion is actually a concept extremely... Yeah. And it does sound very... Either someone, when you're speaking to someone, they either think that you're trying to be metaphorical, or you're crazy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it is a very slow learning process that unless you follow diligently some of the earlier steps, you know, for you to get to the actual conclusion that the self and the ego is an illusion is actually very difficult. So going back to, like you said, the simple truth. So explain a bit about the analogy of the barrel of apples and that being truth, and how that helped to for Descartes to wipe out or to get rid of all that.
Because one bad apple can ruin the whole bunch, you know. So he wanted to start sort of afresh, you know, start new and look for the foundations, really. And so then he decided, you know, sense perception. He regards as not being trustworthy because he's been deceived, and that, for example, the sun appears to be a certain size, but we know from reasoning that it's, you know, far larger than the earth. Things seen at a distance, as one example, and you
think that you've seen someone that you know in the distance, or an object, or someone. Could be something. You get closer to realize, oh. What I thought was actually true, I've gotten closer and I realised that it's not.
And yeah, so we can't trust our senses, essentially. And he goes on then to argue that, well, actually, even things that we believe with certainty are highly doubtful.
Yeah.
And that's where he goes into the sort of, are we in a dream state? And, you know, we've constantly been deceived by a malicious demon.
Yeah.
But if so, nonetheless, what we can be certain of, and this is where his foundation lies, that there's one indubitable truth, you know, cannot be doubted, is that so long as I'm thinking I am something, you know, I think therefore I am, you know, or I am thinking therefore I exist.
Yeah.
So the mere...
And that's the famous cogito ergo sum.
Yeah.
Or in French, as it originally was spoken, is je pense, donc je suis. Yeah. So just to backtrack on that, because that is so critical. So... Mm. I stick my hand out in front of me and I look. I say, my hand is real. The skin is real. Anne's real because he's sat in front of me. You know, you have to be real. I can see you with my own eyes. Now you throw in, you know, the question, well, what if this was all an illusion? Just like in the film The Matrix. When Neo, you know, red pill, blue pill, he says, you know, I want to see the truth. Then he realized that the whole life that he had been living, you know, he was actually playing an avatar. He was playing a character in a game. And then when he was unplugged from this game, you know, he's got the hole in the back of his neck. But he awoke to the reality that everything he thought to be true, from his name all the way down to the job that he had, his physical abilities and mental abilities, gravity, everything was... rules and parameters and characters set in a fictitious game.
Yeah.
So when we go back to Descartes, we say, well, what is the possibility? You know, what if there is a very, very small possibility, even if it was 0.00000, you know, to the power of 101% chance that this existence here is an illusion? And the way that he puts it, what if there was an evil demon tricking you? So that every morning you woke to think that you were this character in the game, when in fact you were a brain in a jar, or you were, you know, Neo plugged on a table somewhere. Yeah. What if that was the case? No. Now, even no matter how unlikely that might be, the fact that there is a sliver, a tiny proportion that this may be true, now we're starting to, it shakes the foundation of, you know, your truths, your absolute truths, this this wisdom that we were talking about as to what is philosophy, right? So he goes, you mean to tell me that even though I'm so certain about everything that is here,
mm-hmm.
and I can perceive with all my senses, the mm-hmm. sight, the smell, the sound, the touch, the history, the memories,
mm-hmm.
that what if, not only what if it was an illusion, but there's actually a possibility
that
this is.
That it's no truer than the illusions of my dreams.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then that throws open a whole new universe of questioning and debate.
Mm.
The question that, well, what if you took the red pill?
Mm-hmm.
And then tomorrow you realize that this character, Bawan,
mm.
that you're playing maths teacher, Vietnamese, born in the UK, was actually like a Sims character in the game.
Mm.
Or you ended up being like a Ryu or Ken in Street Fighter. Mm.
And ultimately,
and that was your reality.
And all the stress related to cultivating this persona,
mm-hmm.
how unnecessary it is if I found out tomorrow that I am just a Sims,
mm-hmm.
that those moments where someone insulted me,
mm-hmm.
or somehow I felt embarrassed because I said something silly in this thing, you know.
Or a death in the family.
Definitely, you know, some sort of damage to this ego, this self. What a waste of my thought. You know, what a waste of my time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
not only a waste of your time, but you realize, I could have been playing this game completely differently.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
And in fact, on that point, so when Descartes decides, just as I suppose, not to take, you know, there's practical sort of code of ethics.
So he
takes this extreme doubt, you know, hyperbolical doubt,
mm-hmm.
As a thought experiment. You know, to, as we said, search for the foundations of knowledge. And the first principle is that, you know, I am, I exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, therefore I am. But that he has a temporary code of ethics, if you like. And he says, okay, you know, but we still have to be practical, that in this is just merely a very philosophical contemplation, but in everyday life,
mm-hmm.
it's merely probable that I'm going to meet someone before mobile phones, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll meet you at 8 p.m. at the cinema, and it's probable that you're going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to throw out anything that has any doubt. Mm-hmm. There is a possibility that you may not turn up because something turns up, you know. I'm not going to, therefore, it's possible. G's not going to turn up. So therefore, I'm just going to go, oh, there's a doubt, you know, throw it out. That's not very practical. That's not. So he looks at how he should live. And this is where I think it relates quite closely to what we were searching at the time, sort of as a, you know, a guidance for how one should live. We were going back to being in our late teens.
Mm-hmm.
At that stage, and I think it's quite a natural question, it still continues to this day, but that you think, okay, how should I best live my life? And even in those days, it wasn't simply a matter of it was quite an abstract kind of thing. It was quite philosophical, right? It wasn't how, you know, we didn't conclude that the pursuit of, let's say, you know, pleasures and carnal pleasures, although obviously at the time, those things have their appeal. But it wasn't just that. I think we had the sense that we were looking for something deeper meaning to life. And we were searching. And if you know, anyone can give the answer, surely the great philosophers must have a sort of answer to, you know, why are you great? You know, what makes you so great? If you know, I'm looking for the meaning. And I know it's not an easy question to answer.
Mm-hmm.
And if we step outside of religion, which provides all the answers, and if supposing we step outside of that, and we say, okay, if I wanted maybe secular kind of ethics, where do I go? But so Descartes, so in his chapter three, third maxims, he has like three maxims on, and one of them, I think, when he looks at, he analyzes. You know, he states that the idea that mastery of your own thoughts. Now, we don't like the term sort of controlling our own thoughts or, you know, let it be. But he used that term that was the secret to happiness, that, you know, mm-hmm. of philosophers of past ages that you know, despite good fortune,
mm-hmm.
if you do not have mastery over your own thoughts, you know, you cannot have true happiness, essentially. That's what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
So that was the most important thing. So
which is so important in our society today, yeah, because we see it all the time, like, yeah. even those that do have the fame and the money, you know, we take, you know, Robin Williams, or we take more recently the guy from Linkin Park.
Yeah.
And you hear so many stories of people taking their lives. Yeah. You know, Anthony Bourdain recently, where you think the guy has everything, you know, money, the fame. He seems like a really friendly guy. But again, without the mastery of thoughts, right, you know, as we know, there are like, you know, several, you know, 60,000-70,000 every day. Without mastery of them, you're a prisoner to.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that's one aspect that when we were looking online and saying, you know, what article can we find in preparation for the podcast, that it was, I found it difficult to that anyone else had I suppose made that connection. I'm sure people have made that connection, but that he identified the thoughts, and probably obviously not the first, but to state it clearly from a great philosopher, that is the key to happiness. And that mindfulness says, well, our thoughts can be our worst enemies. You know, they are, they're not real. They're not us, but they continue to haunt us.
And the way that I've put it is that for some reason, we wake up every day in this ego form, right? Where it's like, I wake up as Guy, you wake up as Anne. I go, my work, you go, you got bills to pay, you got your problems, and I got mine.
Yep. Again, so there are practical reasons for...
But because we understand,
mm-hmm.
and because we practice the mindfulness, we've read the books, and even if we don't believe it all the time, we get that the ego is an illusion, and ego, everything that we experience and that we judge in this ego form also falls apart because of that first premise, right? And once that first premise holds true, then literally everything else falls apart. However, when we are lost in thought, when we are in that zombie or dreamlike state, we get thrown back into this matrix of the ego form. But knowing that we are lost in thought versus being in thought without knowing that we are gives us, we call it like a superpower. Because now you get to play this game with these tools and abilities. Yeah. It's like when I play Pro Evolution Soccer or FIFA football game, and we're playing now, if one of my players gets injured, right, and he gets sent off, or he makes a foul and he sends off, I don't start crying about it. I don't get emotional. I don't, my heart rate doesn't rise, and I don't get sweaty, and then I don't have trouble sleeping at night. Because I realize it's just a game.
Yeah.
And once the game finishes, I move on, right? Now, what if you could apply that same like aloofness and that same detachment from this reality that you play? How much less stress and how much more can you actually start to enjoy the process? You don't want to completely think, oh, well, if this is an illusion, let me just sleep on the streets and let me run wild in this reality. You know, but you have that option as well, right? But we understand that in this game, there are rules, right? If you don't have money, you're out on the streets. If you're out on the streets, you know, you have bad health, you're probably not going to last long. So you kind of need education. Right? But for you to live your life thinking that that is the ultimate, making money, getting a promotion and getting a car, getting a nice house and a wife and 2.5 kids, and that is your only happiness, then you're mistaken, because all your happiness are actually, they take place within the confines of this illusion, of this game. We do need to play it, and for some reason we're here all the time, most of the time. But when in that moment of presentness, when you're being present, which is the key to mindfulness, because the being present and taking that breath takes you out of that game. We don't know really what this space is here, but it's out of this. So it's not identifying what it is, but it's helping to understand what it is not. And when you understand that your key happiness derives from outside of this realm of the game, then you actually have power within the game to understand that it's not about the money, it's not about the car, there's something higher than that.
Yeah.
Right, so 2 points from that. The first one being that the original quote, "I think, therefore I am," you know, you, once you get the basics of mindfulness, you realize how erroneous that is. And until you put the two and two together, it's, well, actually, no, you don't need to think to know you exist, because the whole point of the mindfulness to teach you is that you actually exist more as your true self when you're not lost in thought. When you're, you know, you're focusing on the breath, or you're, you know, you're throwing attention around your body. In that moment, we know that you're not lost in the past or lost in the future. You're being present. And in that moment of present, you're being closer to, or as close as you can be, to who you really are. Not you as Anne, not you as this meat wagon, this physical being that separate from me and you. We're talking about you. And sometimes it gets confusing because you don't want to use the word I or me.
It's convenient.
It is convenient, but you know, real wordsmiths will tell you that it takes away some of what it means. Yes, it is you and Anne, but you're not including a bigger part of it. And what the mindfulness, this being in this place of the present moment, all your ideas of who you are and how we're connected together, and gravity and the earth and the sun and all that, takes place in the form of thoughts that are popping up in that moment. But if the thoughts are not popping up in that moment, then there is no history. There is no, you know, pathways that have been dug through thinking and, you know, identity. It's just fresh. It's just right here and right now. So in that moment of right here and right now, you're existing as everything. You know, I am you, I am this. And if this is all illusion, then I still am everything. Right? And as we hear through different cultures and movies and people's different experience, there are moments in their life where they think, and in that moment, I was connected to everything. I felt like I was one. There was a sense of oneness. It's something very profound that you hear over and over again in different scriptures and in different books. And to be honest, I felt it several times myself. And, you know, that is as close as I could ever be to the idea of dissolving of the ego, where I'm not gi and I'm not limited to everything. But when I'm thrown back into this reality, then it's now I come from this place of like, I'm the guy playing the game, the avatar game. I'm the guy playing the football game.
And when you go back to I am gi and all the rest of it, you realize, and as you said, taking back to becoming the guy that is in, I suppose, control, let's say, in the driving seat. Because if you think about this ego and the identity and everything that we kind of place as important, and how much of it, I'm trying to sort of get to the point of how much free will do we actually have over this anyway? You know, being a 21st century guy, we didn't choose when we were born, you know, to what family, you know, what genetics we have, all those things were just there. And therefore we think, you know, this, but so much went on that made up this ego and chance. So as you said, taking back some of that control, dismantling all that and realizing that, yes, you know, so I'm a man who's tech savvy. Yeah, that's because tech, because these are terms used in the 21st century. So you are already part of the, you know, you didn't have free will over that that point. You were just born into the 21st century, 20th century, and now, you know, a man in the 21st century. And so we say, oh, I'm a tech kind of guy, or I'm you know, I'm tall or I'm short. It doesn't really matter. Those were things beyond your control. So that the whole identity that you've built up with, thinking, well, that's me, but these are factors that are way outside of, you know, any sense of, but once you dismantle all that, that's your first sort of first step towards being in the driving seat.
And that step does take a long time to arrive to. I mean, there's a series of steps that you need, that one needs to travel down before you can get to that. And that's why, I guess, if we were to, if anyone was to leave this conversation and think, you know, what the hell are these guys talking about, the dissolving of the ego, etc., it is a fun, interesting exercise to ask yourself, you know, what if you were genuinely to wake up tomorrow to be in a jar, and like everything, that's it, you're just in a jar and all your reality and all your existence is just that. Would you still be able to find happiness? You know, would you still be content? or would the shock be so profound that you would just like, you know, you just crash? Mm. You know, how would you, how would you, you live? Mm. And what if you live, what if you were to wake up in a brain, but then were still able to experience this life as well? Mm-hmm. How would you take that knowledge, and would that, would you be able not to live this life knowing that, or would it actually help you? Would it give you strength? What could you learn from that?
Mm.
And I think if you start to think along those lines, then you're actually getting closer to truth. Because even Elon Musk said that this reality now, there is more chance that this is actually a virtual reality than the reality that we're experiencing. His argument that, you know, if you look at the way that games started back in the 60s and 70s, where you had the original game, I think it was called, was it called Pong? Where you would just have like two little lines and the ball would like bounce off and it was you to control the up and down. Mm-hmm. The evolution to the way games now look, how realistic they are, right? And that's in the space of like 60 years. Let's extrapolate this another 100 years, 1,000 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we're, you know, even now we're starting to have these virtual reality games where you just like, it's an immersive experience. And, you know, let's extrapolate 1,000 years now. You literally can't distinguish the difference between reality and this reality.
Mm.
And then throw in AI. Right, we have this artificial intelligence where they can create different realities and all of a sudden, but they're creating them at an exponential rate where there's like an infinite number of virtual realities and there's only one reality, right? So he's saying the odds are that we're actually at that stage now where we're in one of these billions of virtual realities. It makes more sense and the odds are more, are stronger than it being that, that we're in this form of reality and we're leaning up to that process. The argument is we're already there and infinite, we're talking, you know, not only infinite, but infinite to the power of infinite, different kind of virtual realities. And so whether that is the case or not, to be already be on that mindset, to think, well, what if this is an illusion, really helps you to understand the Descartes philosophy, to help you draw more happiness from life, but also to help you understand what you can really gain from mindfulness, where it's not just theoretical, where it's actually experiential.
Yeah.
Where in that moment, what we were talking about, what if this is an illusion, you can actually experience, well, actually in this moment, everything else actually is an illusion.
Yeah.
Because in this moment right now, all I have is this present moment. Oh. And in that moment, it's like, it's that big, it's the enlightenment.
Mm.
You know, where you open Pandora's box, or the, you know, you look behind the curtain, you see, you know, everything is revealed.
Mm.
Even if just for a brief moment.
Yeah.
I don't profess to say that I've, you know, I go around and I'm Zen. You know, I still have the anger and I still like, you know, spend most of the time as this gi.
Mm.
But just to remind yourself. And it makes it more profound when I'm having my 20 minutes of meditation. It's like in those moments where it's like, I've brought my attention back to the breath or back to the present. It's like, you can appreciate it on a whole different level.
Yeah. And going back to, you can't, not only, because you're talking about supposing it was a game.
Mm-hmm.
So we appreciate it through the breath and, you know, very practical. But the other aspect, touching upon the benefits, what about, so, you know, your avatar, your character, your football player, has an injury and you're like, oh, but you realize the separation that this isn't, it's only a game. I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. But how the mind allows you, even before the injury, you're not actually injured. So let's look at the rule. I haven't been, you know, I haven't got a bad news from the boss or anything. Mm-hmm. I've just had an email. Mm-hmm. Haven't even opened it.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. I'm already treating it, as we mentioned many times on previous podcasts, like it's life and death.
Yep. Literally, your brain is interpreting it literally as a life or death.
That alone, so before I'm even injured, I've caused myself a life and death fear, fight or flight experience when nothing's happened. Nothing. Yep. So in reality, so this character isn't even real, but supposing he is, he hasn't even been injured. He just anticipates injury all the time.
Yeah.
Anticipates bad news.
Yeah.
Understanding, I think this, the modern side, understanding that this is part of our evolutionary process, mm-hmm. part of our survival mechanism, deep within our mm-hmm. DNA.
Yep.
Then we say, okay, we understand that. We can not necessarily change it, but we don't seek to, right? Mm-hmm. We acknowledge, we notice, and it just dissipates. And mm-hmm. I think that alone, and as you mentioned, if anything, you know, we look at the great philosophers, if anything, what is, you know, what message do we take away? Well, what else is there in a way, right? They've already acknowledged that what is the only thing within our control, or Descartes, at mm-hmm. least going back to that, is what, you know, the thoughts. But
yeah, the thoughts is not in our control. Yeah. It's the response to the thoughts. Yeah, thought. And that's the key differentiation. That, yeah.
So he argues that it's our thoughts, but yeah. So
because as Sam Harris correctly points out, it's like, you can't predict what your next thought's going to be. Yeah. And sometimes we have disgusting thoughts. Sometimes we have, wow, I can't believe I just thought that. But the power comes from not that thought. It's the ability to notice a thought and realize that you are not your thoughts. Yeah. And that is the key.
And understanding the limits of that. Okay, where I can change things. But where things are beyond your control, mm-hmm. understanding that it is beyond your control. Mm-hmm. You can only respond to the situation as the world has presented you. Mm-hmm. And things will not be always be in your favor, as we all know. Mm-hmm. Anything, I think, any person who's lived to adulthood will discover, you don't need to live to adulthood. Your son mm-hmm. has discovered that things are not always going to be his way. Mm-hmm. You discover by the time you start understanding, you know, your own reflection, that things aren't. So any child, any infant mm-hmm. can tell you that things aren't plain sailing. And it could be.
But that's a good example to say that there is neither good or bad, but thinking makes it so. Mm. Like when I don't want him to have too many sweets, he's crying. So he's like, oh, this is terrible. But he doesn't understand that in the bigger picture, too much sweets is bad for you. You should, you know, learn to ration, learn to you know, have a little bit. And if he has to go to bed early and he cries, like in the long run, it's good.
Yep.
So his interpretation of the situation is that this is bad, but it's actually good. Mm-hmm. So that good, bad argument is like, well, it's just how you perceive it to be.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, and that is the key. I think, I mean, people can spend money on having therapy and mm-hmm. et cetera, I suppose. And I think not to discount it. I think that it can be useful for some. But I think I would imagine that some of the messages would be for you to understand that you are not your thoughts. We always go back to that. You are and stop being a victim of this perceived kind of negativity. Mm-hmm. And that realization, that distinction mm-hmm. sounds simple, but actually it takes a bit of practice.
It sounds simple, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
It is the truth. And sometimes we're trying to sugarcoat it because it's so difficult to understand and it's just so far-fetched. But it doesn't take away from the fact that it is that is actually the truth.
And if you're caught up in that, if you're caught up in sort of a very sort of self-centered way mm-hmm. and materialistic way, there's no finger pointing, there's no judgment in this. I think this is something that is across humanity, mm-hmm. right? That these are, you know, we all, the illusion of the self. This is such a convincing illusion, you know, the ego. Mm-hmm. All those things that we protect. Is more, I suppose, intuitive or more natural mm-hmm. than the idea that the self is an illusion, right? The self is here and that, what do you mean, I'm not real? That is more, so we understand that. That's not, and when someone reacts badly, so I remember sort of, say someone, or I used to react to people who get very sort of unnecessarily out. I'm like, calm it, man. What's the matter with you? Mm-hmm. But actually, you understand that they're just humans. We're all sort of brothers in this. And the human condition, being human, is not easy. So some people react differently. And that's okay as well. You know, it's not a judgment thing. It's just, I know. This is years of evolution. Mm-hmm. Evolution has made us this way. So if you're a bit jittery and, you know, what's the matter with you? Calm yourself. It's only an email. What's the matter with you? But actually, I think I've come through this journey that we've taken together through speaking to the psychologist who breaks down the chemistry of this frosting one, you know, I can't remember her name, the lady from the American sort of.
Oh, Loretta.
Loretta.
Yeah, Loretta Burney.
Breaking it down so clear. And then you understand, yes. So just on a very personal level, I've become more understanding that, because you can't expect people to, why can't you just react philosophically with equanimity? Because you're human, and I was like, I'm not any better to this day.
And
I
got training. This needs training, like going to the gym. And I think that's what people need to understand. It's like you can't just pick up a book and to get to this understanding does require training, mental practice, experience. You know,
you become far more forgiving, right? You know,
hate compassionate.
Compassionate. Love is wise. Hate is foolish. Because we understand our own errors. We spot it all the time. Right? We're not perfect examples of, you know, as you said, Zen and all the rest of it. The idol. We're not. And we understand. So when someone does, or even acts too selfishly, overreacts, all this, you know, I think I've understood. Not to say we can't perhaps intervene where we think, you know, it's necessary or it's possible.
So I think that's a great way to end this. And I think that, in conclusion, going back to the philosophy linking with mindfulness, this experience that we have in life, you know, we've established that it's actually an illusion, right? It's the ego. But we're thrown into this illusion every day. And right now we're seeing the highest levels of stress, depression. There's always record cases of male suicides and female suicide. You know, teenage girls self-harming at her new high. And it's like, people are suffering. So this game that we're playing, in this game, people are suffering. And we suffer as well. But if you can just grasp the idea that what if this was all a creation, a fiction, and you were experiencing it actually as a virtual reality or as an avatar, then what skills and what does that help you bring into this reality, to this game, to make you enjoy it and play it how it should be. You know, one of the ideas we were talking about, it should be about loving everyone, helping other. If this is all you and this is your game, and imagine this was all your movie, then it would be foolish to want to hurt anyone else or to think badly on anyone else. You would want to enjoy it as much as you can.
Yeah.
And if you just go and think of all the best games you've ever played in your life, Street Fighter or FIFA or any kind of shoot 'em up game, they all take place and they were created within this game. So in fact, the game of life is the best game you've ever played, right?
It's a great thing to take
away. So so if I'm thrown into this game every day as this illusion, then what an amazing illusion it is to be thrown into. Wow.
So
right?
Interesting you point out the word thrown into, the concept of thrownness. I have to throw in something actually.
And we'll end on this one then.
Yeah, thrownness is an existentialist concept, actually, that we are thrown into our circumstance.
Yeah.
So I go back to, and this is quite a central concept of, I think, Martin Heidegger's philosophy on being thrown, the concept. I think there's a German word, I haven't read it. But essentially that we don't decide on our circumstance, our parents, genetics, you know, moment in time, we've just been thrown and we have to cope with this. There you go. Yogi, 6 foot, handsome, whatever. Figure it out. You know, you're Mr. X or whatever with depression, and that's a genetic. Deal with it. You know, life is not easy, you know, but how do we cope with this?
All right. So, you know, I hope that's been a really interesting and enlightening conversation. You know, we're going to get this back on track. We're going to get more of these going on now. RenaissancePodcast.com. So wherever you get your podcasts, Renaissance Podcast, check us out. Help support going to the website, RenaissancePodcast.com. You'll get all the old episodes there. iTunes, however you want to download it, and show your support, show your love. And we're, you know, we're really trying to establish ourselves as key people of influence of mindfulness in the UK. And, you know, our Action for Happiness podcast, that's our monthly podcast where we, like I said, this is really a platform that allows us to speak to the leading thinkers, the leading scientists. And this podcast is more a platform for us to reflect upon and give our feedback on our own opinions, which may not be shared with the general public or with the majority, but it's a place where it comes from our passion mm-hmm. and it comes from our, you know, if we were to share and if we were to give our best thoughts on our best feedback on how, you know, all the points that we've gathered together, mm-hmm. you know, this is the platform for us to, you know, to help feed it back out.
I think open-mindedness as well, look, in practice, in what we preach, if we are wrong about certain points or, mm-hmm. you know, or if there is new information, of course, we don't know everything. No one knows. There's so much out there that we don't know.
Yeah.
That, you know, this is however limited our understanding of mm-hmm. things are. These are just opinions and, you know, that we like to share with each other and that we enjoy this format of conversation, recorded conversation. But of course, there isn't any one person that has the simple answer to all of life, but we don't claim any of that. And I think openness to suggestion, always, I think that's a great teacher.
So if you've enjoyed it, smash the like button, subscribe, follow, show your love, and we'll keep producing the content. It's all free. And we appreciate the support. All right, peace.